and I can talk about quantum feedback control and continuous time error correction. So who wants to have NMR, quantum computing? That's one, two. Okay, who wants to have decoherence free subspace? Damn. And who wants feedback control? All right, so what I'm going to do the, I guess I can do, who said someone else? Who said that? You want to talk? You're very welcome. Yeah, so I guess what I can do, I can talk about DFS today and maybe try to patch something and talk feedback control. On my talk was supposed to be about something else, but yeah. Yes. No. No. You show up at 10 a.m. No, because I have a talk to give anyway, so I'm giving it. Okay, so you know, I haven't looked at that talk since I gave it, but it's only 2 months ago. But I'm going to be shooting in the dark a lot. All right, so for those who don't know, yesterday Andrea introduced us to quantum error correction. So basically, you know, you have errors in the environment, introduce errors. Error correction is sort of a software fix for it. It's how you handle information so that you can recover. Even though there's error on it, you can recover the information. So, man, that's fine. Yeah, so here's what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to say why we want to look for decoherence-free subspaces. I'm going to just give a like, very quick example. Then I'll go through more formalism, more the theory of it. And then I'm going to try to go and explain how you can find a DFS for arbitrary collective rotation using irreproducible representation and all that jazz. So this talk is prepared assuming, so I gave that for an error correction course. So I was assuming knowledge of stabilizer codes. So who doesn't know stabilizer codes? Oh, that's good enough. All right, so I'll try just to explain it quickly as we go. All right, so as I was saying, so quantum error correction, they're good. You know, they can correct a lot of errors, but this, you know, this, there's still error left. You know, you reduce your amount of error, but at the end, unless your code is completely perfect, there's still error. So one way to even reduce further is you can start concatenating codes more and more and more. And just before I keep on going, I'm an experimental physicist, and I know there's a lot of theoretician in the room, so you know, my explanation might be shaky sometimes, but physics-wise, they're good enough. So basically, you know, our goal is to find a way actually to encode information so that they're error-free. So the environment doesn't act on them, doesn't do anything non-unitary on it. So that's the goal of decoherence-free subspaces. All right, so well, that example was for the class. Like one of the obvious ones is any stabilizer codes. So in a nutshell, a stabilizer codes is you find an abelian group of the polygroups, and you define your code as all the plus one eigenstate of all those operators in your stabilizer. So basically, what I'm saying is, if you have a stabilizer S and a state in your code, then it's a plus one eigenvalue. Okay? So basically, obviously, then if your errors are any operator in your stabilizer, then it doesn't do anything to your code. So that's one of the trivial examples that you have a stabilizer code, you have an error model which is generated by your stabilizers. The stabilizer is mapped to itself, so it's a perfect code. There's no errors introduced. So another example is collective Z rotation, or collective defacing, right? So anything which is created you know, through rotation. But when I say collective, is if you have n qubits, if the rotation happened on the first qubit, they happen on all the qubits, and of the same amount. Okay. So let's take for two qubits, for example. Now, if you look at the state 0, 0, you apply your collective rotation, you pick up, you know, a certain phase. If you have the 1, 1 state, you pick up the same phase, but basically the complex conjugate. But if you have the 0, 1 or the 1, 0, then the 0 pick up an I theta, and the -1 pick up a minus I theta. They cancel out, so the, you know, the 0, 1 and the 1, 0 just get mapped to itself. So we see that we can use those two states. So you have two qubits, and you can use the subspace span by those two states to create an encoded qubit, which is completely decoherence-free with respect to the collective rotation, the collective dephasing. And you can easily generalize this by saying, well, if I have n qubits, and I take any state with the same amount of ones and zeros, then it, you know, they're always going to pick up all the same phase in front of it. So up to a phase, the subspace just gets mapped to itself. So you can encode, you know, if you have n qubit and you take, let's say, k ones, then you have a dimension, you know, n choose k subspaces. So you can encode like log 2 of d qubits. So here's a more formal treatment of it. So the first one is through operator sum decomposition, or as you guys might know it, as a cross representation of noise. So when you say that you have a cross representation, is you can always write your channel as, you know, your initial state gets mapped to basically an incoherent sum of certain operators, such that your operator sums to 1. So, you know, by Krauss theorem, it tells you that it's a CPTP map, so it's all good, it's all physical. So without going into the details, the end result is what you want is that each operators in your Krauss decomposition basically map your state to a unitary evolution to it. So K is basically, if you want to have a decoherence-free subspace, then any state in that subspace have to be unitarily mapped to itself. And this unitary here, very important, is independent of your Krauss operators. So basically, in a nutshell, what it's saying is this. Okay, if you write your operator EA, all your operators EA, in the basis of your DFS and, well, the rest, in the basis of the rest of the space, you basically block diagonalize your operator. So it means that your subspace gets mapped to itself, and the mapping to itself, like if a basis state gets mapped to itself, the unitary of the mapping is independent of that basis. So, well, I mean, it's the same thing as saying it's a unitary on that subspace. So it takes that, and that would define the fact that, you know, you can have a certain DFS. And you can just look through it, you know, go through the calculation. You know, if you take a pure state, for example, then you have the cross decomposition go on and on, and it basically gives you a decoherence-free subspace with unitary evolution. So there's still some debate in the literature, okay, decoherence-free subspace, it should be basically fixed. Some others say, oh, no, you can allow unitary evolution. But, no, in principle, unitary evolution, you can always take, you know, as long as you know it, you can deal with it. So that was one way of representing noise. Another way of representing noise, which is widely used in physics community, much less used in the mathematical community, is the Lindblad representation. So it's basically, instead of going, as we saw before, with the cross representation, we use the basically the dynamics of the system. We use the differential equation. That was the word I was looking for. Differential equation of your density matrix is basically given by this chunk, which is the Liouville equation, von Neumann-Liouville equation. What's the real name for it? Marcus knows that. The Liouville? Yeah. So we got the Liouville, which is the coherent, okay, just the unitary evolution due to the Hamiltonian of the system. And this part here is just due to the fact that you have an open system. So you couple to the environment, that assume that the environment is Markovian. So basically it means that environment grabs some deformation and it's gone forever. Okay, it's not coming back. So your environment is just incoherent. And you know, that's an operator that takes that form. So that represents open system. So then you can work through the same thing that if you have it in those FA, they're your limblad operators. It's basically the operators that create your noise. So for example, if it's a dephase, if your noise is a dephasing, those FAs will be like a Z rotation. If they're a T1 process, when your spin flips, then it's going to be like a sigma plus or a sigma minus operator. So then you basically end up with the same kind of conclusion that on your subspace, on your decoherence tree subspace, then those Lindblad operators has basically to act as a constant on it. You know, they basically take your DFS to itself. And then also, the extra requirement is that your Hamiltonian has to be irreducible on the DFS. So I think that's an abuse of notation. I think I should have been saying has to be invariant on your DFS. So basically, if you apply the action of your Hamiltonian on the DFS, it brings the DFS to itself. So just like in the operator sum representation, it just means that if you diagonalize, if you put your Hamiltonian in the basis of your DFS and the outer subspace, then it's just going to be block diagonal. So it's sort of to ensure that you have a coherent evolution that's going to be, that's going to bring your subspace to itself. So that one is explaining how you can find DFSs, because so far I assume we have a DFS. What condition does it? Basically, I found a necessary condition. Now I'm gonna try to explain how to actually find a DFS, and that's where I start being shaky, because it's all irreproducible representation, which I'm, I don't work too much for it, but let me try to go through it a little bit. So. For those who don't know, an irreproducible representation is basically what I've been talking since the beginning. Is that, say you have a space, and then you have operators that act on it. So if you find a certain subspace that you apply all the operators in your group, and that subspace is always mapped to itself, then it basically means that that space, that your group is reducible. So basically, you can find a basis such that it's going to take all your operators and put it in block matrix. And then what we call an irreducible representation is that we do that over and over and over again, unless each subspace, there exists no other subspace in it that will be invariant under the group. So in other words, is you take your whole group and you block diagonalize it. That's what it means. So, all right, so here's how you start. So you have a cross decomposition of your noise, your channel, and you create an algebra. Just like Cedric was talking, you create a C-star algebra. Basically, you take all your operators in your noise, you take all the complex polynomials in it, that creates a C-star algebra. And then I say, consider the commutant of your algebra. Commutant is basically defined as the namesake of all the operators that commutes with all the operator in your algebra. Okay? And now, for example, just take... I'm just assuming that the third point, the fourth point exists, but assume that in your commutant, there's a common eigenspace of all the operators. Not necessarily with the same eigenvalue. We don't care about the eigenvalue, but let's say there exists a common eigenspace to all the operators. And just, if you work through the little math here, so basically if you consider, one operator in your commutant, in that common eigenspace, with its eigenvalue CA, for all the value, all the state spanning that eigenspace, then you work through it and you see that your operator, the noise operator applied on that state, is also an eigenstate. It also belongs to this eigenspace. So basically, just by doing that, you already found your DFS. Okay, because that DFS, under the action of your noise, is just mapped to itself all the time. Okay, and then, so that just showed that, it might exist, but there's a bunch of other conditions, which I don't get myself into it too much. And then, so from that, then you can go the other way around. is that you can give me a group, and then you can say, I look for the irreproducible representation of it, and then this, from that, I can find subspaces that are going to be DFS. And the thing is, irreproducible representation theory is huge. There's a huge literature on this, so there's almost the point that here's a group, you feed that to an algorithm, it's like, okay, here's the representation. So basically, in a nutshell, what I'm saying is like you look at your, actually not your group, but your algebra, you find the representation of it, and from your irreproducible representation, you can define, okay, those spaces will be a DFS, that one will not, and I'm going to show you next how to do that. Oh, and also, very, very important point for the existence of the DFS, you need symmetry of your noise. If there's no symmetry at all, you will never find a DFS, because basically your noise is going to act all over the place and bring your quantum state everywhere. So basically, in some sense, what I'm saying is by symmetry, in quantum mechanics, you always associate symmetry with a conserved quantity, and a conserved quantity is always associated with a commuting, a commuting operator with the Hamiltonian. So roughly speaking, it just means that if your commutant of the noise algebra is empty, then you can just forget about finding a DFS. So that's why we always talk about collective rotation or collective T1 process or collective dephasing, and stuff like this. What time is it? GC, can you stop me when it's... all right, so basically, so here's roughly an idea of how, once you have your representation, how you can find your DFS. So if you have a one-dimensional irreducible representation, so it just means there exists one state that gets maps to itself, okay? So that trivially defines a one-dimensional decoherence-free subspace, right? You can encode nothing in it. Then if you have two equivalent one-dimensional, by two equivalent, I mean they're related unitarily, so if because they're one-dimensional, they're related by a complex number. So then at that point, you have two states that are mapped to each other. I mean, two states are mapped to themselves. And because they're equivalent, if you take a superposition of those two states, then they would be mapped to itself too. So basically, you have two states, and all the superposition of them would be decoherence free. So basically, once you do your representation, if you find two one-dimensional representation, right there, you can encode a qubit in it. Okay? Now, if you have a two-dimensional irreducible representation, then most of the time, right, your matrix is gonna look... So somewhere when you decompose your matrix, you're gonna have a bunch of blocks, then you're gonna have a two-by-two blocks that might have number in it. So basically what it means is if you take the two states of that, well, they're going to be sort of, one state is going to be mapped to a superposition of itself and the other one, and so on. So basically, it's going to define a DFS with unitary evolution. And now here's the kicker, is if you have two unitarily equivalent two-dimensional representation. So what it means, so let me write that a bit bigger, is you're gonna have a bunch of stuff here which we don't really care about. You have a 2x2 matrix here, and another two equivalent unitary matrix there. So what happened is those two guys, actually, right? So that's a direct sum of this guy, but that part here, you can actually write it as M2, which is a two matrix algebra, tensor identity, which looks like Cedric was talking before. So basically what it means in that basis, you have a subsystem structure. And the beauty of it is that on one of the subsystems, your noise acts like nothing. So now we don't talk about decoherence-free subspaces anymore, but we talk about decoherence-free system, subsystem, or they call it noiseless subsystem. Okay, so that's in some sense, a generalization of DFS, and there's a lot of work being done on that too. So those are examples. Should I go through that? Yeah. All right, so let's now go down to basically the end result, which, well, it's not a result of mine. That's like the first paper on DFS by Zanardi and somebody else back in 97, I think. It's been quite a while ago. So let's consider collective rotation. So collective rotation is that they're defined like SU2 rotation, right? So you can always write it as the SL2, an exponentiation of the SL2 algebra. And if you work on multiple qubits, then your X polymatrix here is actually a sum of all your individual polymatrix. Okay? So basically, for those who did a basic quantum mechanics course, the only thing it is, it's addition of angular momentum or addition of spins. And there's like books, there's encyclopedia being written about that, right? So basically, you look at that, it's like, collective rotation, spin, irreducible representation of spin is what? It's just when you add 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 spins together, you open a book and it gives you the block diagonal of it. And so as we said before, we're actually after the one-dimensional representation, irreducible representation of it, okay? So, you know, so that's what I was saying, like Clebsch-Gordan did all the work, so basically to decompose all your addition of spins into a certain direct product of, you know, when you spin, let's say you add a two, spin two, right? You're gonna end up with spin zero, spin one, spin two, spin three, spin four. If you add spin two, spin one half, you're gonna end up with zero, spin one. And we know that when you have a spin j, then it's 2j times plus 1 degenerate. So if you have a spin j, and then you look at this projection on the z-axis, you can have a value of minus j, minus j plus 1, minus j plus 2, all the way up to j, right? So basically, if you look at the subspace, and the subspace spanned by the spin j, then those are 2j plus 1 dimensional. So basically what you're looking for, we're looking for the one-dimensional subspace, which are essentially a spin zero. So we're looking for the spin zero subspaces. And this, now that's when we get really into the hardcore math theory that I don't understand anything. You can always find basically your number of spin zero in some sense, or how they call it, the multiplicity of your one-dimensional irreducible representation using a Young tableau. I don't know if that tells anything to anybody, but if it does, it's basically you take the square Young tableau and then you use the Hooke law and then big formula. You can find that on Wikipedia. And that gives you that the multiplicity for one-dimensional representation is this. Okay? Where big N is the amount of spin you add together. So this number gives you the number of one-dimensional representations. So what it means is if you add big N spin together, or big N qubits, if you have a DFS of big N qubits, you can find basically the log two, DFS of, no, of log 2 of that dimension, or basically a DFS that will encode log 2 of this qubit. And if you look at for 4 qubits, then you get that the multiplicity is 2. So you need only 4 qubits to create a DFS, which is the decoherence-free subspace for any collective rotation about any axis. And so another way to calculate the degeneracy, I guess, is like, let's say you add up a bunch of spin 1/2, okay? So if you add, if you have two together, there's two choices. You either get a spin one or a spin zero. Then once you add the third one, you can either get spin 1/2 or spin 3/2. You have a third one, you can go to spin two, spin one, no, and so on. But the thing is, like, if you look at the four, for example, the way to get a spin zero, you can basically have 1/2 plus 1/2 and then minus 1/2 twice. Or you can go to zero first and then go up to spin 1/2 and goes to zero. So basically, when you add like a bunch of spin together, it's basically the number of way to add up to zero gives you a multiplicity. So if you're good at combinatorics, you can find another way of finding this formula. I tried, and I suck at combinatorics, and so never got anything. Another interesting result from it is if you look at that, and you take the Stirling expansion of it, basically a Stirling expansion is just when n goes to infinity is how you expand a factorial. So basically this tends to, so the log 2 of this number tends to 1. So basically what it means is, as, no, basically by the infinity, sorry, the log, basically the log of this over n. So what I'm saying is, as you add an infinite amount of qubits, you basically start encoding one encoded qubit DFS per qubit. So at the infinity, basically, no, there's no overhead on the number of qubits you can encode. And yeah, so basically for the 4-qubit DFS, for collective rotation, you have those states will be your encoded state, which are actually a very, they're very intuitive for anybody who did a little bit of spin physics. So this is basically, you know, two singlet state tensor product together. So we know that singlet state is a one-dimensional DFS in two dimension, right? We know that if you have a singlet and you apply a unitary on one qubit, it's equivalent to apply the unitary dagger on the other qubit. So if you look at that a little bit, it's like applying, you know, U tensor U on the singlet is just equal to the singlet, right? That's a well-known fact. So if you tensor two together, then of course it's going to be, if you apply, you know, U tensor four times on that, it's going to be DFS. And the other one here, this is basically the singlet state, the general singlet state, if you add two spin one together. Okay, so that one is basically adding two spin zero together. And those here, those are like the, you know, the sigma plus sigma minus, so, you know, the triplet state, which are spin one. And so when you add two spin one together, you always have two possible singlet, like, you know, spin zero state. But that is like the, how they call it? I think the general singlet state. So basically it's the state of lowest energy in spins. And those you can, it's fairly easy to find. So actually at the end we use all the machinery, but just to end up having a very intuitive solution to your problem. I think, yeah, so that's one example, right? So if you find the irreducible representation for adding four spin one half, you end up with a matrix like this. Like say you decompose your noise, so your X generator of your noise, or your X generator of the rotation, it decomposes like that. So this is the X matrix for spin two. Those three of them is a spin, it's a X matrix for spin one. And those are, well, no, spin zero. Okay, so it will always decompose on that. So you see here we have our two one-dimensional representation. And the nice thing you can see in there actually is, right, you have three copies of a spin one. So basically you have, so if you consider also the Y and the Z, you're gonna have the SU, so basically you have the three-dimensional representation of SU2 tensor three times. So what it means is using that you can encode a Q-trit subsystem. So using four qubits, you can have a noiseless Q-trit subsystem. It's something just I just sort of figured out this morning when I was looking at that again. And yeah, I think I'm almost done. So yeah, conclusion, the existence of a DFS, well, it requires symmetry, as I explained. If no symmetry, well, obviously you can always find approximate DFS. So there's no symmetry. For example, you couple the environment in different fashion. You assume that you are coupled in the same fashion, and then you know that introduces errors. But just the fact, just using a DFS, you get rid of a lot of error, right? And then from that, you decrease your number of errors a lot. Then you can start concatenating with quantum error correction or concatenating with another DFS, and you can keep on going. Then some literature on that. Yeah, or dynamical decoupling for physicists is like when you start banging on your environment, so you know, it sort of doesn't affect as much. Yeah, so I talked about that already. I can go to noiseless assistant. And yeah, so the nice thing with noiseless assistant is it's easier to do computation on it, because you actually you do computation on something that has a subsystem structure, right? So you can always cook unitaries that's going to apply on one subsystem and not on the other one, which is what you're looking for. While when you do with DFS is actually you try to do a unitary on a subspace. So those ones are way more trickier, and it's a subspace which is usually highly entangled. So it's much trickier to come up with unitaries or finding your encoded polys and everything. So yeah, I think I'm done. There you go. Oh yeah, I cannot win the iPod, so don't waste your vote on me. I know you want to, but any questions? Yeah. Physical example. Let's say you have a system and you couple with an environment, but the environment has a very short wavelength. So what we mean by that, it has a very long coherent time. Okay, so basically you're coupled to a coherent environment. So in that time, it's like if you have all your qubits, they're going to be coupled in the same way. Okay, so you can see it. Huh? Yeah, so you right? So you have like a, let's say you have a bunch of spin together. That's your quantum computer. And then you have the environment. And the environment has like is very correlated. It has a very long wavelength. So basically the way you couple to this guy and the way with this guy coupled to the environment would be roughly the same. And by okay, and when I talk about long wavelength, I'm kind of assuming the spin boson model kind of thing when your coupling is normally dependent on your distance from your spin to the boson of the environment. But if you have a very short wavelength, it's independent of the distance of it. So you kind of all couple the same way. So basically, the effect on the environment on your system is similar for every qubit. So that would be one example. So okay, here you're talking about not evolution, but transformation on your DFS and everything. So one thing I forget to mention is DFS are well, I kind of mentioned at the very end. They're not very well suited for doing operation with them, but they're very well suited for a quantum memory, right? So basically, you put the information there and let it go, okay? So you encode it, so you never touch it again. So the whole thing of making the operation, so no, I agree with you, and you'd make operation, then you get out of your DFS, then you have a lot of coherence, and yeah, but that's they're not really suitable for that, but that's why they came up with the whole noiseless system. Well, yeah, I mean, it's like whenever you do fault tolerant quantum computing or error correction, right? So you can never do something which is always fault tolerant. There's always going to be a place in the preparation which is going to be non-fault tolerant, and then you just do it over and over again. It's in the preparation, right? So that you can sort of take a certain hit on the number of time you do, but once you know you have it, then you just let it go. You mean like when you prepare the DFS? No, sure, but I don't know. Like I'll see in NMR, for example, which is the physics that I know. Let's say you want to do a quantum memory, right? Preparing a state is not very long, but if you want a quantum memory that lasts for like 2 days, but preparing your state takes like 5 milliseconds, then what's 5 milliseconds compared to 2 days, right? So here we're talking like in the very long run, when you have T2s of 1 second, but you want to encode something for like a minute. Okay, so you can sort of deal something. We can do experiment right now with, you can take a hit with a decoherence on the short time, because you lose, a few couple percent of fidelity. But, and do something that on the long run that you can, never hope of having signal at the end. But, using that, you will. Any other questions? Yep. Is there a what? I think there is. But I think Bacon and Wiley and who was? Yeah, I think those two, and Julia Kemp. I think they work a lot on stability and stuff like that. But I'm not too sure. But I think there's been some work on it. And it's probably like the whole theory of approximate DFS. They certainly like talk about stability and stuff like convergence and. Anything else? All right, let's thank me again. So